It is the winter of 1969. Provincetown police are deep in the woods of nearby Truro. Through the snow and ice, they're looking for clues. Two women from Providence, Rhode Island, are missing. A baby blue Volkswagen Beetle believed to belong to one of them has been found abandoned nearby. In the process of investigating the area, they find two bodies. But they aren't the two women they were looking for. And a warning, this subject matter is gruesome. Listener discretion advised.
The age of the decomposed bodies may go back beyond 6 months, 8 months, 9 months. We don't know what took place during that time, and there are at least 2,000 or 3,000 missing females in the United States, and we don't know how many may be buried in the Truro woods.
That's then Bristol County District Attorney Edmund Denise at a press conference March 1969, talking about the discovery. Sound is from the Associated Press. The police would go on to find the bodies of Patricia Walsh and Marianne Wysocki, the bodies they were looking for in that same section of the woods roughly a month later, alongside the bodies of Sidney Monson and Susan Perry. That made four murders. The women appeared to have been sexually assaulted, their bodies dismembered, and buried in numerous holes in the ground. All four would eventually be tied to a local man named Anton Tony Costa, a year-round resident of Provincetown, known by many as a charismatic transient, a hippie, a drug user, a drug dealer. Costa would eventually be tried and convicted of the murder of Patricia Walsh and Marianne Wysocki. He was sentenced to life, but would only serve a few years before reportedly dying by suicide behind bars. Legendary photojournalist Stanley Forman covered the murders for the Boston Herald American, and we sat down with him recently to discuss his coverage of the case. We started by asking him to talk about the day he visited the site where the bodies were found.
I knew nothing about Truro and very little about Provincetown. You know, that was a place you visited. You took a boat and you got off there. And as I drove down with Eddie Corsetti, I knew more about the story. And the chief of police, it was a different time. He took us into the woods, into the area, actually showed us the trees where the women were tied and, cannibalized.
What was it like to stare at those trees, and what kind of image did you think you were going to make?
Well, I don't think, you know, back then I was, 22 years old, 23 years old. I don't think that I was bothered by the incident itself at the time. I was there to do a non-biased story, show everything, talk to people, get pictures to go in the newspaper to go with Eddie's story. And I made a picture in the woods and, you know, show trees and that type of thing with the chief of police and have him in the picture. It was a different time, different thoughts. I saved the negatives of Anton Costa coming out of the courthouse, but I don't have any of the other negatives. So I don't remember what kind of pictures I made. The key thing for us was Anton and his wife, Avis.
So you mentioned your well-known photograph of Anton Costa, who's Tony Costa, coming out of the courthouse. And, of course, that's a big piece of the story here is Tony Costa. So how long was it between your visit to those woods in Truro, North Truro, and when you first heard about Tony Costa?
I still remember being down there for 3 days. If we spoke to the police chief after he was captured, we were down there doing the story about his arraignment, I'm sure.
Was he what you imagined when you saw him?
No, he didn't fit the bill at all. I mean, here was this, really, you look at the picture, he's a handsome guy. I think he had a car. I have to go look. I'm not going to go look at the picture, but I'm pretty sure he had a jacket and a tie. And of course, they might have let him put on good clothes, not like now. If they were taken into custody, they'd be most likely be in prison garb. But this handsome guy came out, big smile, gave his wife a big smile. He didn't know she was going to be there. They looked at each other and, you know, oh, hi, you know, hi, honey.
Yeah, it's really quite strange. She's smiling at him like it's their front porch and he's bringing out lemonade.
Yes. I mean, did she not believe that he did that? You know, I don't remember her reaction. I don't think she ever said, oh, I know he did it. And even around town, I think it was a surprise. He did not fit the bill.
You described his outfit accurately from the picture. He was dressed up, you know, and you said, did she not think he did it? At the time, did people think he did it? Did you think he did it at that time?
Well, I didn't know enough about him. I do. Here's the one thing I remember, that when people we talked to, he was a, what's the word, a jack of all trades and a master of none.
What does that mean?
Well, that means he could do a little bit of everything, but he couldn't do anything very well.
And was that, and my understanding is you'd heard a lot of people call him that, that that was kind of a reputation of his.
Yeah, I remember the Ed Corsetti using that term that he got from other people.
You have seen incredible things, and you have photographed incredible things. You know, many of our listeners will remember the photo you took of the white man with the American flag and the flagpole attacking the black man in Boston during busing.
Ted Landsmark, the soiling of old glory.
Yeah. Is there anything about the photos you took and the reporting that you were a part of with Tony Costa and these serial killings in Cape Cod that really stays with you today?
Just the fact he came out smiling out of the courthouse. That's why I saved those negatives. I mean, he's a murderer. I mean, he knew it. I was told recently, I didn't read the book because I knew someone wanted to talk to me about it. I'm sure Casey's got all the detail. But they tell me in his memoirs or something in prison before he killed himself that he had admitted to doing it. What was he, 28 years old? 29?
He was in his 20s.
Yeah. And as I say, you look at this guy and say, boy, he's got the whole world in front of him. And there it is.
Why didn't you read the book?
I'd like to keep my own memories of it. I didn't want to know that much.
And is there anything in particular besides that moment, that smile, that you want to hold on to as a memory?
The fact that the chief of police brought us into the woods and showed us where they were. And you know, I know as much as I want to know about Tony Costa.
That was Stanley Forman, Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer and photojournalist. We did read the book. Some of Forman's photos, including that well-known one of Tony Costa leaving the courthouse during his trial, are included in a new book called Helltown, The Untold Story of a Serial Killer on Cape Cod. It's what made us want to speak with Forman. So in it, author and investigative journalist and Cape Cod native Casey Sherman explores Costa's killing spree as well as the culture at the time of those atrocities. Sherman is here in Studio 2, joins us. Casey Sherman, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Holy cow, what a story.
What a story.
Yes. So let me just start with reactions from you from what you just heard from Stanley Forman.
Sure. Well, Stanley and I go back a long way. We were colleagues in television news for some time, and Stanley's got, you know, vivid memories of an incredible career in Boston. And I will say that I've covered 20 to 30 homicides in my career, and I've never seen anything as brutal as this. I don't think there's been a more vicious serial killer since Jack the Ripper stalked the women of East London back in the 1880s. That's how graphic and gruesome these crimes were.
All right, so I want to walk a balance here. It's 11 a.m. on a weekday morning. I don't want to get too...
I understand.
And we did lay out the basics of the story, as you heard, before we played our conversation with Stanley Forman. Anything else about the story? Let's just round out the story for listeners who have not yet read the book.
Sure. Well, you know, the story is it's a forgotten serial murder case on Cape Cod in 1969. A young, charismatic, hippie-like messiah was luring these beautiful, smart young women into dark areas in the woods of Truro and killing them in the most gruesome ways. And you mentioned, obviously, you know, it's morning here, and I understand that the subject matter is sensitive. And I've had to live with the autopsy photos and the crime scene reports and all the photos that I've had to, you know, absorb over time. And it's still very difficult for me to even talk about. But, you know, given the fact that I had to write this book and tell it in a unique way through the prism of two writers that became darkly obsessed with the case, I thought, okay, I can do this.
So those two writers, Norman Mailer and Kurt Vonnegut, and I'm going to come to them in just a minute. I want to stay with the case because it's fascinating to me that you grew up on the Cape.
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear about this story when you were a kid, and what did you hear?
Sure, I did, and it was told in passing almost as a joke. You know, Tony Costa had the nickname Tony Chop Chop on Cape Cod, and he was, you know, considered the boogeyman for all the little kids on Cape Cod. I was, in fact, you know, when I was born at Cape Cod Hospital the weekend that Tony Costa moved into that rooming house in Provincetown. And just a few days before, Patricia Walsh and Marianne Wysocki came down for a weekend away and never made it home.
So that gives me goosebumps, especially knowing that you also have a relative who was a victim of the Boston Strangler.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, my 19-year-old Mary Sullivan was the youngest and final victim in that notorious 1960s murder spree. So in the, you know, in the course of my writing career, I'd gone down and taken that dark journey with a serial killer before. I wasn't willing to, you know, take another look at that. I didn't want to do it. There are other stories that I felt compelled to write. But during the height of the pandemic, I just wanted to get out of the house. So my brother and I took a drive into Provincetown, and we're driving down Commercial Street, which was completely abandoned. And we're talking about the ghosts, real and imagined, in Provincetown. And that ultimately led us to the topic of Tony Costa. And we joked around about it in my car. And then I went back to my writing office and I took a fresh look at this case. And I was shocked at just how disturbing it was.
So the case, as you write it in this just riveting book, was so much more than those almost cheesy stories that you heard.
Oh, of course. You know, and again, I mean, there's a lot of psychology with regard to this case as well.
Split personality,
split personalities.
For Tony Costa?
Yeah. He you know, they called it ego splitting at the time, where he had an alter ego that he could blame, you know, for these brutal crimes that he was committing. And he was really the epitome of a living Norman Bates from Hitchcock's Psycho. He was an amateur taxidermist. He had a love-hate relationship with his mother that he projected onto these, you know, young women whose only crime was kindness and compassion. And, you know, and letting their guard down for a very charming, charismatic man who had a very dark part of himself.
So we're speaking with Casey Sherman, who is the author of Helltown, which explores serial murders in 1968, 1969, Provincetown area, Truro area. Fascinating story. Casey, one of the things that really struck me about the book is that you do two things in the book. You introduce these living, breathing people who also become characters. These are the authors who become fascinated with the dark side.
Right.
And then you answer the question that I'm screaming all the way through the book, which is, why don't we know about this? So let's start with, I was just stunned. All of a sudden, Kurt Vonnegut and Norman Mailer walk into your book. So first, let's remind listeners who Kurt Vonnegut and Norman Mailer are.
Sure. Kurt Vonnegut and Norman Mailer are, you know, two of the iconic literary figures of the second half of the 20th century. Kurt Vonnegut wrote Slaughterhouse-Five, which became a declaration of the anti-war movement in Vietnam. Norman Mailer was a multi-Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and journalist himself, wrote The Executioner's Song and a litany of other titles. And it's interesting that these writers have been all but forgotten, you know, in kind of today's, you know, literary culture. So one of my, purposes of writing this book was to reintroduce these two giants who had a lot of darkness in themselves to the reading public.
So Vonnegut was living in Barnstable and finishing Slaughterhouse-Five.
Finishing Slaughterhouse. So
what are the chances?
I know. He was he had spent 20 years living on Route 6A in Barnstable, and he was a commercial failure as a writer. He was writing science fiction. No one was paying attention to his work, and he was really struggling with his personal memoir, which was a fictionalized account of his life as a POW in Dresden in the 1940s during World War II.
Which was also brutal.
Brutal. So, a brutal moment in world history. And, you know, Vonnegut survives. Little does he know that he's going to encounter, you know, near equal brutality, at least singular, you know, in his backyard when he comes home. And then you've got Norman Mailer, who, again, is a brilliant guy, but very dark. People don't remember that Norman had, you know, nearly killed his second wife, Adele, with a penknife during a dinner party in 1960. And both become, as I said, darkly obsessed with this murder case that's starting to unfold in their own backyard.
So, okay, so I'm going to push on you a little bit on this part, because sure. this is a nonfiction book.
Yep.
As you're exploring the internal monologues of Vonnegut and Mailer, and neither of them look good, but in your book, man, does Vonnegut look bad. A violent, abusive, incompassionate, unempathetic person. Some of that is fictionalized. So how did you feel that you had the right to tell that story that way
sure.
of these two authors?
Because, you know, quite frankly, I was inspired by their writing to take a different approach to this book. I've written 15, you know, best-selling books, and most of them have been true crime. And this is the first time that I've sprinkled in some fictional storytelling to provide that connective tissue for the reader. And everything that's in either Kurt's mind or Norman's mind had been harvested from 1,000 different interviews that they had given over their time. And I would say that, you know, Kurt is struggling here. You know, is he a brutal character in the book? He's got the darkness in him, but he's also struggling to raise not only his family, but the family of his dead sister. He is not coming to grips with his own post-traumatic stress from World War II. And in the afterword of the book, you know, I repurpose a letter that Kurt had written to my own father in 1973. And it was a critique. My father sent him a query letter. He was an unknown graphic artist, my dad, and wanted to get a shot at illustrating some of Kurt's books. And Kurt wrote him back at the height of Kurt's career and said, "You can't work out of your mailbox in Hyannis, Massachusetts. You have to go to New York." And it was a pretty strong letter to my dad. My dad didn't take it well. My family didn't take it well. That letter sat in a drawer for decades until I began to explore Kurt's past. And I thought, this letter isn't a mean letter to my dad. It's a beautiful letter. Kurt's writing a letter to his younger self saying, "You need to get off Cape Cod if you want to be successful." So now that letter is actually framed and hanging in my office. I thought it was a really beautiful note from a guy at the height of his powers.
Did you ever feel, you've talked about the autopsy photos, you were born in a hospital when Costa's moving into that rooming house. You have a dark tie to the Boston Strangler case. As you were going through this, did you ever fear you were going to slide into a little bit of an abyss with the weight of everything that your life is tied to?
I did actually, slide into that abyss. And my wife had to pull me out of it because, you know, I was living with those images for quite some time. And as I said, I've been to, you know, upteenth crime scenes and watched autopsies being performed live. But I can't imagine something like this. This is, you know, these women, these victims look like they'd been attacked by a shark. That's how vicious the attacks on these women were. And it just, you know, what I wanted to do also in Helltown was, you know, really focus on the memories of these young women, that they weren't just statistics. They weren't just victim number one through four. They're real people. And as I said, their only crime was just being kind to a stranger or somebody that they knew. And Tony Costa took complete advantage of it in brutal ways. And, you know, there are people around Costa that I think protected him, much like, you know, Charles Manson had his family. Costa had his disciples as well. And many of them are still living in Provincetown today.
So that brings us to this last part, which is that you then tell us why we don't know this story. And it's basically, wait for it, an intersection of Chappaquiddick and Charles Manson.
1969 is a year of reckoning in American history. And I look at it very similar to what we're dealing with in 2002. You know, I mean, you know,
2022.
Thank you. There's a lot of darkness out there. You know, hope is all but gone. You know, in 1969, it was right after the assassinations of Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King. You've got an unwinnable war in Vietnam. You've got the DNC bloody protest in Chicago. You've got the moon landing. You've got Ted Kennedy in Chappaquiddick. And somehow all of the characters, or at least the main characters in Helltown, all are involved, you know, either directly or by, you know, by proxy to these major political shifts in America.
And so that also led to distraction. For example, the DA, Denise,
yep,
thought this was going to kind of make his career. Everybody's going to pay attention to the serial killer trial, but then Manson.
Then Manson comes around, and Ed Denise exaggerated the murders to the press, and you didn't have to exaggerate one, you know, iota of what Tony Costa did to these women. But he, you know, he called Tony Costa a cannibal and all these things that Tony Costa actually didn't do. But then Manson comes along and just takes all the oxygen out of the room because of not only who he was, but the people that he had targeted. Sharon Tate, you know, I mean, it was the L.A. Hollywood culture that people still talk about to this day. And it just took Tony Costa right off the front pages.
All right. So having been through the book, thumping good read, right?
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Also, a piece of history that I can't believe I'd never even heard of. When listeners read this book, when your audience reads this book, what do you want them to take from it?
Well, I want them, you know, to understand that, you know, you have to be aware of your surroundings. If you know, if you're a young man or a young woman, you always have to, you know, and I tell that to my own kids. You know, here was an unassuming serial killer that people just didn't look twice at. You had Stan Forman talk, you know, just about that earlier. So he didn't look like a killer, but he was one of the darkest figures in American history. And, you know, I tell people, imagine that Jack the Ripper was resurrected to stalk the women of Cape Cod. That's not fantasy. Mm. That actually happened in 1969.
And what are you working on now? Can you tell us?
Yeah, I'm working on an L.A. noirish story that takes place in 1958. It's the Lana Turner shooting of her boyfriend, Johnny Stompanato, with her 14-year-old daughter who allegedly pulled the trigger. So this is a cross-section of gangsterism and glamour in old Hollywood, and I look forward to jumping in.
I'll probably read it. All right. Thanks so much. Local author and investigative journalist Casey Sherman. The new book is Helltown, The Untold Story of a Serial Killer on Cape Cod. It's out tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Tuesday. Casey, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.